You're listening to the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on China's foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world, brought to you from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center located here in Beijing. I'm Paul Hanley, the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, and I'll be your host today. I'm thrilled to have with us Alex Gabuev from the Carnegie Moscow Center to discuss China-Russia relations and Russia's Asia pivot. Alex is a senior associate and the chair of the Russia and the Asia Pacific program at the Carnegie Moscow Center. He came on board in February. We're pleased to have him as part of the Carnegie family. His research is focused on Russia's policy towards East and Southeast Asia, political and ideological trends in China, and China's relations with its neighbors, especially those in Central Asia. Prior to joining Carnegie, Alex was a member of the editorial board of Kommersant Publishing House and served as deputy editor-in-chief of Kommersant Blast, one of Russia's most influential news weeklies. Alex, welcome to the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. Thank you for being on today's podcast.
Great to be here.
Alex, you have recently published in February and March, one with the Asan in connection with the Asan Forum, which you participated in and gave a talk, and another with the European Council on Foreign Relations. Both have referred to Putin's pivot to Asia. In your view, when did the pivot begin, and how successful has it been to date?
I would say what people really need to understand about Russia's attitude to Asia, and particularly the attitude of the Russian elite, that even now, a year after Crimea annexation, people want to wake up somewhere in Mayfair, knowing that there is a report from a boarding school where your kids get educated, that you have a private jet going to Côte d'Azur to a nice party, or you get invited to Chelsea. Mm-hmm. So personal outlook is very much plugged into the old European world. Asia is new. Mm-hmm. It's not very much personally attaching many people in the leadership and in the elite. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much driving as being part of the West. Mm-hmm. That's the basic fact, and that has been throughout all the periods since the independence of Russia and breakup of the Soviet Union, that mm-hmm. Asia was remote, somewhere there, thousands of kilometers away, completely different civilization, where Russians are very much plugged into this European context, language-wise, cultural-wise, spending pattern-wise, mm-hmm. And they were never serious about it. Mm. So they sorted out the border issue with China, which was very good. And since then, the China card or the Asia card was always used as a bargaining chip talking to Europeans. Remember 2006? Putin came to Hu Jintao. They signed two memoranda about gas pipelines, mm-hmm. and they never happened, because they were not intended to be a real project, mm-hmm. but to scare the Western customers, which achieved its result. Mm-hmm. So the first really serious thinking about the Asia pivot, in my view, started with the global credit crunch, 2008-2009, mm-hmm. when Russian political community and the business community realized that there is no way to go to Western stock exchanges. They are short of money, they are short of capital, and there is a huge market just next door, full of capital and full of interest to get the resources out of it. Mm-hmm. So that's the first attempt, serious attempts, to penetrate it. That's the year when we got the oil deal and oil pipeline to China constructed, 2009. That's the first stage for the Russian first ever IPO in Hong Kong Stock Exchange. That was Rusal. In 2011, mm-hmm. early 2011, but that didn't last as the crisis mm-hmm. was over and people just turned back to business as usual with and Europe.
It sounds like it was very energy focused.
Yeah.
I take that correctly, that this was mostly about energy and other aspects of the relationship in terms of the economy and security. We're not there yet.
Right. On the security side, that was always very symbolic as Russia turned more and more non-Western first and anti-Western on the later stages. We have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was set up as a mechanism to sort out the border issue between the newly formed countries and China, and then became an ambition to become a more comprehensive security organization, which it never became and will probably become in the future, but not yet. Right, it's more about China and Russia trying to do the rapprochement, join military drills and so on, but not about really comprehensive regional architecture. Mm-hmm. And definitely it's very much anti-American directed. So the Astana Declaration of 2005, when the countries demanded that America withdraw troops from Central Asia, is very much the essence, but nothing really systemic has happened since.
Mm-hmm. And how quickly is this pivot happening, in your view? And is it the right policy for Russia?
I would say that since 2014, right, since the annexation of Crimea and slow imposition of different types of sanctions against Russia, Russia definitely has no other choice as to look for other partnerships. And in terms of capital and technology and markets, Russia may require. There is only one place to go, it's East Asia. But as Japan and South Korea are U.S. allies and have to be following the discipline of an allies, and Japan is also a G7 country, so it has to impose sanctions as part of this mechanism, there is only one large player they can go to, and it's China.
Mm.
So when the pivot was invented or thought through as a strategy back in the credit crunch and then 2012 when Putin came to power, that was really diversifying from European dependency to diversify to East Asia. But what's happening now, it not pivot to Asia, but pivot to China, which is happening in a dire situation where you have to do that on the Chinese terms.
And how receptive has China been today?
And China has been not too receptive. So it has picked up some cherries, picked up some nice things it wants to, but with a lot of domestic risks inside the Russian economy. For example, if you are a company and want to invest into Russian company or Russian project, with the current devaluation of the ruble, you cannot calculate any reasonable financial model for that, right? You don't know how much the agencies will downgrade the Russian economy, right, and the Russian sovereign risk. So it's very scary. Even being a large SOE, right? Mm. Being a private investor, it's even more scary because the expertise is not there.
Mm.
So Chinese are very much putting it on hold, and definitely domestic developments in China with anti-corruption campaign and slower government reaction to different stimulus is definitely affecting that relationship as well.
Three Russia-China summits will take place this year. First in May, on May 9th, in Moscow for Russia's commemoration of the 70th anniversary at the end of World War II. Second one in July in Ufa for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting. And in September in Beijing for China's 70th anniversary military parade, which will commemorate the end of World War II. What do you say to the intense speculation in recent months that the appearance of warming ties between President Xi and Putin? What do you say about do you think that Xi and Putin are forming a much stronger personal relationship? And what notable changes have we seen in the relationship between Russia and China as of late? Are China and Russia really becoming much more aligned, as people like to say?
I would say that on the leadership scale, we definitely see much more closer ties personally between Putin and Xi. Remember then, Jiang Zemin may be the last Chinese leader who fluently spoke Russian, but he was 20 years older than Putin, right? Hu Jintao was 10 years older. So with Xi, like, Putin is just half a year older than Xi Jinping. So they are more or less same generation people with more or less same outlook. Putin's personal diplomacy is very much concentrated on building this personal relationship with top leaders. That was his job back at KGB.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, the two guys got drunk during Putin's birthday party in Bali back in 2013. So when Xi Jinping was the only foreign guest at a very small private party of 10 people in Putin's compound in Bali. So that's where the relationship went very smooth, though they together had sympathy towards each other. You may see that...
Sympathy towards each other in which regard?
Putin had always certain image here in China
yeah.
as a strong personal leader
right.
who can fly a fighter jet and who fights corruption and who fights oligarchs.
Yeah.
And many people speculate in Russia and heard that from some Chinese colleagues that he might be emulating or at least looking at Putin's, sees looking a little bit at Putin's public image there. And I know very well that Russians are looking into anti-corruption campaign, which is happening now in China very closely in how Xi Jinping executes this and what's really going on.
And in terms of the two leaders, Putin and Xi Jinping's view of the West and the United States, is there a common view there?
I would see, like, from what you get from the talks, right, and people who participate in the talks, they seem to be very much united in the stance. But I would say that the backgrounds are different. So Xi Jinping's favorite movie, as he claims, is Save Private Ryan, right? So he's much more westernized in like his daughter was at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
He likes to play soccer. So he's much more global man than Putin is. And him serving in Eastern Germany shouldn't mislead anyone because mm-hmm. he was serving in a second-tier city,
mm-hmm.
basically doing counterintelligence against Russians working there. So he's not that internationally, not that much exposed to it. So I would doubt that Putin, coming from KGB background, has very yeah. much conspiracy in mind about the West. I would say Xi Jinping might be much more open about it and realistic.
In the last 2 to 3 decades, China has really grown its economy, as you know. In the early 90s, Russia and China's economies were on par with one another. And now China's is 4 times the size of Russia's. So there's been, in a very short time period, this sort of flip-flop in who, from an economic standpoint at least, is the stronger of the two. Does that affect the relationship at all? I mean, does President Putin or the Russians harbor any resentment or ill feelings towards China because of this reversal, with China now a much stronger economic power?
I would say that this ill feeling and some deep suspicions on the long-term Chinese intentions were always there on the Russian side. And if you go back to Soviet history, right, Soviet-China border was one of the most militarized border in human history in terms of the mass of army units held there. So Soviets were not afraid of China as an economic powerhouse, but as a demographic powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the map of Eastern Siberia and the Russian Far East,
yes.
where there are 6 million people and there are about 120 million people just across the border,
right.
people sometimes get afraid. And when they don't operate on the proper facts on
yeah.
the levels of migration there, which is not so much, like there is no Chinese, visible Chinese presence or Asian
yeah.
presence in the Pacific Russia, which is sad to me. But people...
I remember traveling there in the late 90s and went into Russia and spoke to border guard officials. And one of them described the northeast part of China as a boiling pot of 1.3 billion Chinese getting ready to boil over.
Yeah, yeah, and that's very much Russian perspective on it, and I would say the Moscow perspective, where the local perspective is that natural migration pattern for Chinese is going to a richer province or to Southeast Asia or to a normal country, which
mm-hmm.
is the U.S. or
mm-hmm.
Europe. It's definitely not Russia. So I would say that still these deep harbored feelings, we had a very complicated border story, right, and border history. Russia invaded China, Russia chopped part of its land historically and so on. And we were happy to sort it out legally, and thanks to Putin, that was one of his major achievements. But these deep-seated mm-hmm. suspicions are still there, mm-hmm. and I would say China growing strong as an economy, and it happening, as you rightfully say, so rapidly, just mm-hmm. one generation that Soviet used to be like, the Chinese have this expression, "苏联大哥." So it's no more about
Russia is the big brother.
Right, it's not more about Russia is a big brother. On the other hand, Chinese were very smart and skillful not to show that. Mm-hmm. So Russia always, as a vulnerable power, wants to have this equal relationship. They mm-hmm. are obsessed with equal relationship with the U.S. or with Europe, which the West doesn't necessarily want to grant, or want to grant according to certain policy, democracy, human rights record-related standards. Chinese were very smart in not showing that they are the real big brother, but treating Putin with all respect and equality. And that goes very much to the Central Asia, for example, where Russia has natural interests, mm-hmm. long-term history of presence, military assets, some economic assets, and where you see Chinese investment just flooding the region, buying it off, which is normal and natural because they are after natural resources. Russia is not wanting to buy Kazakh oil or Kazakh mm-hmm. gas because we have it all.
Yeah.
But Chinese are very skillful in showing appreciation for Russian historic stance and position in Central mm-hmm. Asia.
Let me shift, Alex, to Russia's ties with Japan and North Korea. Here we've seen in both cases over the past year a degree of warming, possibility for diplomatic breakthroughs in certain cases with both countries exist. What, in your view, do these changing dynamics mean for regional geopolitics and for China?
I wouldn't say that this dynamics is stable, as we definitely saw Abe's government trying to reach out to Putin, and Putin very much wanting to pivot to Asia, including Japan, and not to China only. But that was definitely put on halt by Russia's moves in Crimea and then eastern Ukraine. So even if bilateral summit happens, I don't think we have any sort of breakthrough on the northern mm-hmm. territories. Mm-hmm. So the momentum for the political will mm-hmm. was there, but mm-hmm. it was lost. On North Korea, there is a very new and inexperienced team which does the bilateral government-to-government commission, which has a very big target on the investment side and bilateral projects. And observing the history of Russian-North Korean relations, I would be very cautious in how much you can actually deliver in a year or two. So I would see that the Chinese will be very patient in observing how much actually happens. And my bet is that, unfortunately, not so much will happen.
Mm-hmm. Let me, with the final question, let me turn to China's new initiative called the New Silk Road Project. How do business circles in Russia, political elites, and the Russian people see China's new initiative, more as a threat or as an opportunity?
Russian people are illiterate, so they don't know too much about it. And I would say even on the elite level, the understanding that this project is there and it's going to happen in one form or another is just forming as we speak, right? So the concept is pretty new, and there are some internal groups which study what's actually is on the table, and that's mm-hmm. everybody is puzzled as Xi Jinping is just about to present his new adopted view and to present the roadmap of which projects will be invested in.
Right.
But the business community definitely sees, the private business community sees a lot of opportunities because for the Eurasian Economic Union and the Customs Union, where a cargo going from Western China to Europe can cross just two borders and go directly in a speedy way for a very stable territory without any additional geopolitical risks. Unlike the southern route through Iran and northern Iraq, or a very expansive route through the Caspian Sea, crossing the Black Sea as well. So Russia has a natural selling point. Mm-hmm. And there are some concerns on the Russia railway monopoly side, which is a large player, sure. with the CEO being a close friend of Putin, which definitely wants to control the whole project and so on. So Russian government is just trying to figure out how to combine its own agenda and interests with what is on the table on the Chinese side.
Great. Well, we expect a Chinese white paper out soon on the New Silk Road Initiative, which hopefully will provide more details. And next time you come back to the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, hopefully we can continue our conversations in this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for hosting me.
Well, thank you, Alex. Thank you for coming. Thank you for spending time with us today and throughout this week. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. If you'd like to read or learn more about Russia-China relations and Russian foreign policy, you can find more of Alex's articles on the Carnegie Moscow website at www.carnegie.ru, or follow Alex on Twitter at Alex Gabuev. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.